You are listening to the Sarah Fader podcast. This is What Anxiety Feels Like, and I'm here with my homegirl, Rebecca Lombardo. How you doing?
I am doing great today. How are you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. Coffee is always a thing that I enjoy. You're not into coffee, though, right?
No, I actually do not drink coffee. I'm trying to even give up pop completely, so...
Oh my gosh, I'm over here fiending. I love that you say pop. Like, that makes me so happy because it reminds me, we say soda in New York, but it reminds me of my roommate from college because she lived in upstate New York and she said pop all the time.
Yeah, it's a big thing here. If you say soda, people will just automatically ignore you. So
what is it? So like if you say soda in Michigan, like what do people think?
They think you're acting like you're from another state, basically.
But does soda mean anything? Does it, like, mean anything at all?
Not really, no.
That's so funny. It's like you're speaking, like, a weird language.
It is. That's exactly what it is, actually.
That's so funny. Yeah,
it sounds like you're trying to be fancy schmancy, and you're not, so.
Yeah, totally. So, I have so many questions for you. My brain is, like, going in circles. But one of the things I wanted to ask you is, like, how did you get started writing for Huffington Post?
That's a good question. It was something that I really wanted. It was like a goal that I was striving for, and I was just constantly, you know, trying to get it. And I would submit things to them and submit things to them, and they, you know, would not pay attention. And finally, I read an article online, and the name of the girl that wrote it escapes me, but she gave out some really good tips. And in the article, she gave out some email addresses.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that she used to get on there. And one of them was Arianna Huffington herself, who I believe has since left the Huffington Post. But one of them was her email. And I emailed her and like four other people in one period of time. And in about... Jeez, it was only like 3 days or so. I heard back from Arianna herself, and she wanted me to write for the Huffington Post. So,
you know, it's funny that you say that, because I have another friend that did the same thing and had success, and it makes me sad that that is not an option anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, I don't know how it works now, if it's a completely different process or... if you can still contact, you know, the same people, just not her or the way the whole process goes now. But yeah, they've changed a lot of things. You know, their logo's different and the way you contribute is different. And, but yeah, that's really, I struggled and struggled and struggled. And then I read this article and sent one right to Arianna Huffington. And next thing I knew I was on.
Oh, that's awesome. So you got into HuffPost before she left, right?
Yes. Yes. It was last year sometime, I believe.
And how long have you been blogging about mental illness?
Since 2013. Okay. Since I got out of the hospital in 2013.
So tell us a little bit about your story. Like, you've had mental health issues for how long?
Since I was 19. And I'm 44 now.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about when they first came out and how that looked.
Well, you know, when I look back on the past, I realize that even as a young kid in elementary school, I was experiencing anxiety because I would have days where I didn't want to go to school, and it was the old standard. I have a headache, I have a stomach ache, I don't want to go. And I look back on that now, and I see that as anxiety for not wanting to go to school. And I went through that all through my school years. And it wasn't until I moved out of my parents' house when I was 18, and I was living in an apartment with another girl, and things just really bottomed out for me. I was working two jobs. I was trying to take classes at a community college on the side, and I just... I burned out, and I really just completely lost it. And I went to my parents and I said, look, I really need help. I'm taking, you know, no dose to stay awake during the day. I'm taking a handful of Excedrin PM to go to sleep at night. You know, I'm having nightmares. I'm, you know, having suicidal ideation. I really need help. So that I was about 19 then, and we went in and we went to the community mental health facility because my parents didn't have mental health coverage. Mm-hmm. And, I, you know, started there, and I went with the county that I lived in. I worked with them for several years, many years, until after Joe and I got married and he got coverage. So I don't have to go through the county anymore, which is a blessing because they essentially treat you like a number on a file.
Yeah. Oh gosh, that sounds terrible. That's one of the reasons that I'm afraid in some ways to apply for Medicaid, because it's scary, right? Like, it's in this country to get mental health coverage, it's kind of like, I don't know. It's not easy, right? I mean, and that's kind of what you're saying. So when you started having these, you know, like the suicidal ideation, and you were having trouble functioning, what was that, the 80s or the 90s?
That was the 90s.
Okay. Yeah.
So about 1992, 1993.
Right. So see, that is very familiar to me because I started feeling similarly in college, right, when I was 18, 19. And, it, you know, I don't know if you can relate to this, but for me, nobody talked about that, you know? Like,
yeah.
It wasn't a thing that we felt like we could discuss openly, so that made it harder.
Yeah, I didn't talk about it to anybody. I hid it from everybody that I could possibly hide it from, except for the boyfriend that I had at the time who, you know, eventually became, you know, we'd been together since high school and we were together for a long time. But he eventually started to sort of use it against me to sort of kind of, I don't want to say brainwash, but he would say things that I did or said that I didn't actually say or do.
Oh, so and, yeah, right. So that's like gaslighting, kind of like blaming you. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, and me, I didn't want to be alone. I used to be one of those, I don't want to be alone girls. And, I would put up with anything to not be alone. So, you know, I was with him for quite some time. We were actually going to get married. So I'm grateful that that kind of went away pretty quickly.
Yeah, no, for but, real. I got it. Sorry, my phone is being a dick. One second.
Oh, that's okay.
I don't know why that's popping up. Anyway, so technology fail. let me quit this.
So from there, I went back and forth from, you know, the county, and then eventually we found a doctor, and something would happen and I would need to go to a different doctor, because I eventually, once I got actual coverage, I decided to become picky about it.
Well, yeah, actually, you know what?
I'd been treated.
Right. Let's back up. Let's back up for a second, because you had this boyfriend in like college-y age, right? And then you met Joe. So when did you meet Joe?
I met Joe. Joe and I met online in 1998.
Okay. So you say online, like where did you meet?
Well, people will laugh, but, you know, we were on AOL. We're still on AOL, actually. And at the time, around that time, AOL had this pen pal thing.
Oh, my gosh, that's so awesome. I love that.
Yeah, where you could go and you could find people in your state or out of your state, whatever you wanted. And if their profile sounded interesting, you could just email back and forth. And that's what we did. We emailed back and forth for quite some time, and then we met in person, which was very scary for me because at that time I was heavy duty into self-injury and low self-esteem and everything. And, you know, we actually, our first date was we went to go see the South Park movie.
I love it.
And, it was after that things kind of, I think, sort of got too heavy for him. He wasn't sure if he could handle dating someone with all of the baggage that I came with. And, you know, coming from a very Catholic background, he wasn't sure about, you know, because I've always said that I can't have kids. I don't plan to have kids. So, you know, that was a little bit of it for him. But after about a year, he decided that, you know, he couldn't, I guess it was more than a year, it was maybe 2 years, he couldn't do without me anymore. So he started calling again, and May 2001, we officially started dating, and August 2001, we were married.
Oh, that's wonderful. So what was it about, the dynamic between you that made him hesitant? Did it have to do with mental health issues?
Yes, I think it did. I think he was, obviously, like, you know, you meet someone that's practicing self-injury, that's confusing for many people.
Right.
You know, and I understand that. I fully understand why that would be confusing to people.
Right. So what is it about that, right? I think that self-injury, self-harm has a lot of stigma attached to it, as you mentioned. So tell me more about what that is. Like, why are they confused by it? Or what are their feelings that you've experienced about self-injury?
Well, let me really think about it. The biggest misconception, which is sort of not a misconception at the same time, is that we're just doing it for attention.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, people are doing it for attention. But I'll cite my experience, for example. I either did it because I was feeling useless, or I felt like I'd screwed something up, and I would obsess about it and self-injure because I felt like I deserved to be punished for certain behavior. Or I was dealing with anxiety, and my anxiety would build up so bad, and if I used self-injury, it calmed my anxiety. But here's the weird thing, is that if I did cut myself, it was sort of like saying, I'm here, I'm in pain, I need help. But then I would cover it up and I wouldn't show it to anyone. So it just became this sort of vicious circle where it was happening over and over and over again, but I never told anyone about it that could help me figure it out. It wasn't until I eventually was pretty much head to toe scars that I finally went to my parents, and they were just blown away. They could not fathom what I could possibly be doing that for. And it's not,
let me ask you this. So they didn't understand, or they were, maybe your parents, how did they react? Like, what did they say or do?
They literally didn't have words. Like, I specifically remember the day I was sitting on one couch in the living room. My dad was on one chair. My mom was on the other couch. And I just lifted up my pant legs and I showed them. And they didn't have words to say. My mom finally said, "Why? Why are you doing this?" And I couldn't explain it to her. I didn't have words to describe it at that point, and I just kind of sat there and cried.
Wow. That's just powerful. That's intense.
Yeah, it really was. So, you know, you start a relationship with somebody that's, now granted, when Joe and I officially started dating, I had cut way back. I mean, I wasn't doing it hardly at all, but still, that's a big thing. And he would come into my bedroom at my folks' house, and, you know, at that time I was on 9 medications, and you see 9 pill bottles laid out, and, you know, the whole thing, I think it kind of would scare anyone to think, God, you know, what's going on with this girl? So I think it was mainly just fear of the unknown and not really sure what he was getting himself into that sort of made him back away for a brief period of time.
So when he backed away, what did that look like? Were you still talking as friends? Were you not talking at all?
We weren't talking at all.
And so he then decided to get back in touch with you. Do you remember mm-hmm. how that happened?
I remember that I was sort of chatting with a guy over a long distance relationship that lived in Connecticut. We were sort of talking, and Joe came back and started just calling periodically, and I would talk to him a little bit here and there, and then we started to get to know each other more and more. And then towards the end of 1999, I ended up in a group home because my self-injury got worse, my depression got worse. So instead of putting me into the hospital, they put me into this group home, which they basically trained you how to live life again. You know, they taught you how to cook. You did art projects. You know, you kept your room clean. You did your own laundry. You know, you had group therapy, the whole thing. So
how did you like that experience?
I loved it. Honestly, I felt like I was at summer camp. It was an amazing experience, and that place doesn't exist anymore that I've heard, and that makes me really sad because while it was a small facility, it could only take about 4 or 5 people at a time. Mm. It was effective. It was incredibly effective, and I was just really, really grateful for the experience.
That sounds really, it sounds like it was a positive experience. Now, I'm actually curious, how did you get your diagnoses and what are they?
Well, my diagnoses have come at different times, you know, because I've seen a few different doctors. And the first one was, like I said, back when I was 19, and that's when the bipolar came into it. But as, it's funny, as my appointments with doctors progressed over the years, as I would get to a point where I trusted a doctor and I would see them on a regular basis, my diagnoses would change a little bit or what have you. So I would go back and forth between, like, you know, just bipolar disorder and then
good, and then
bipolar disorder with psychoses came in frequently. It sort of changed off and on. And then eventually I started to hear this borderline personality disorder come into play. And you know, the very first time I ever heard it, my mistake, because I didn't know what it was that it was a form of multiple personality disorder. And I couldn't understand where they were coming from with that. So I had to study up on that and find out exactly what it was. So that came with one doctor, and she also diagnosed me with generalized anxiety disorder, PTSD, panic disorder. And eventually I started to struggle with agoraphobia and social anxiety. So those are all the different things that I've been diagnosed with over the years.
This is going to be a ridiculous question, but which one is the most fun?
You mean ironically actually?
Ironically.
Okay.
Because none of them are actually fun, right? But like ironically.
That's a tough one. I would have to say at this stage in my life, the agoraphobia and the social anxiety are the two biggest thorns in my side. I mean, there's days when, and it's embarrassing to admit, but there's days when I don't even leave my bedroom.
I get it.
Yeah, we have a little refrigerator in our room because at night, if I go downstairs to go get like a drink of water or something, I was falling down the stairs because I was so medicated. Mm-hmm. And my husband got really worried about me, so he put a little refrigerator in here so that I could have bottles of water and stuff so that I didn't have to go down the stairs and fall to get something to drink because I get thirsty in the middle of the night. So, you know, I've got that, and, you know, that's all I care about, and I'll be up, be in my room, you know, on the computer, watching TV, watching movies, working on blogs or whatever, and all of a sudden I'll look up and it's 4:30, 5 o'clock, and I haven't even left the room.
Wow. So, what is it that triggers that agoraphobia? Like, it's not like that for you all the time, but it's something is triggering it. So I'm just curious about that.
So that's a good question. I think in a certain, there's a certain part of it that has to do with my appearance.
Mm-hmm.
I have been struggling for several years now with my weight, and it's been become a huge issue for me. It's hard for me to go out in public without feeling like I'm being stared at or made fun of, because of my weight. And, I don't know. There's times like when I'm driving, which I haven't done in quite some time, but there's times when I'm driving and I feel like, say I'm about to make a right-hand turn and there's cars, you can turn on red and there's cars going, you know, in either directions, and if they stop and then you're able to turn on red, I will envision in my head those cars crashing into me, and it makes me freeze up and, you know, start white knuckling the steering wheel, and I got to turn off the radio, and I got to, you know, stare at the road, and it's a lot of things. Like, I feel like I'm constantly going to get lost. I'm terrified I have a major fear of getting lost. So I only drive around my hometown where I'm from. And, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I can relate to that thought of, like, getting hit by cars or whatever. It's weird because, I mean, it is an intrusive thought, right? That's how I view it. And it's also, like, a bit of paranoia because it's not rational. Like, it's just the things that pop into our heads, you know? Mm-hmm. I used to, though, actively want to get hit by a bus, like, when I had suicidal ideation. Mm-hmm. Just because, like, it seemed easier than, like, trying to die. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think it would be obviously much more painful than, say, some other way.
Right. But we've obviously
makes sense.
Right, we've thought about these things. I mean, the thing is, like, it's not a rational thought, right? I think that's, like, the misconception about people that want to die or, like, that are actively suicidal or even thinking about it, because it's not, like, I don't know how to explain it, but it isn't like you actually necessarily want to die. You just don't want to be in pain anymore.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's, you know, in 2013 was my last attempt, and, you know, I feel confident that it will be my last attempt. You know, I feel like I learned a lot from that experience and having written the book afterwards and everything. But it wasn't, I never really specifically said in my brain, I want to die right now. It was more of a, I felt like I was worthless and the whole everybody'd be better off without me thing came into play, and I just didn't want to be here burdening people anymore. Another part was that my mom had died and I wanted to be with her.
Right. So let me ask you this. This is totally unrelated, but mm-hmm. What have you seen 13 Reasons Why?
I have.
Okay, tell me what your opinion is about it. You've seen all the episodes?
Yes.
Okay.
This is my opinion about it. I liked it. I thought that it was well done. But on the other side, being someone who has, who knows people who have lost someone and have been left with questions, or, you know, being myself, somebody who thought about suicide and knowing that my family would be left with questions, I feel like leaving behind tapes to literally torment the people who had some sort of part in what you did, and just, I don't know. It feels like you are trying to destroy other people's lives while you're not thinking clearly and you want to destroy your own life.
Right. So I like that. Actually, I like your take on it. And I also speculate about what kind of mental health issues Hannah had, right? Because it wasn't just that she was bullied and sexually abused. I mean, I think that she had some diagnosable issues, right? Like,
right.
She could have been BPD, like she could have been bipolar, she could have been a lot of things.
Right. And I don't know, I just feel like that wasn't, you can maybe say something in a note, say, you know, people, you know, contributed to my decision to do this, but I feel like leaving a tape that somebody can listen to all the time and tells them all these horrible things, wouldn't it have just been better while you were alive to go to someone and say, hey, this horrible thing happened to me?
Right.
Instead of leaving behind all of this that is going to destroy all these people's lives. I mean, the one kid didn't even actually do anything.
Oh, you mean Clay?
Clay, yeah. He didn't even actually really do anything to her. And that's going to, you know, in the world of the show, would screw him up for the rest of his life.
Totally. I mean, there are points, I feel like, in the series where she tries to go to adults and they don't know what to do or are not helpful, right? So it's like, I feel like it's a mixed bag. But I want to just switch gears for a second. I really liked your perspective on that, though. That was really informative. I want, we're almost out of time, but I want you to tell us about your book and where we can find it.
Okay, sure. Basically, my book is, it started when I got out of the hospital in 2013. It started in about November, and it began as a blog. It's just so you know, it's not a conventional storybook. It began as a blog and became a book over the course of a couple of years. Just my recovery from a suicide attempt, you know, getting back into my life and all of my ups and downs. You know, there's good posts, there's bad posts, there's in between. And it's about 2 years of my life, recovering and struggling with recovering from self-injury and just kind of trying to get my life back after losing friends and losing family members and everything after my suicide attempt. And eventually coming to a point where I'm healing and things are getting better. So it talks a lot. It covers the whole gambit. It covers self-esteem, body image, PTSD, self-injury. It covers everything. So if you're someone that's sensitive to any of those topics, here's my trigger warning. That, you know, I do talk openly and frankly, and I don't pull any punches. What happened to me is everything that's in that book. So it's called It's Not Your Journey. And I recently released sort of a second edition to it. We took it away from the publisher that had originally published it, and we had it edited professionally again. We changed the cover, we changed some of the material that was included and added some other material. So it's a little bit different of a book, but the story is still the same. And you can get it at Amazon, Amazon.com. You can get it BarnesandNoble.com.
All the places. That I wanted to like interject that, because I know you'll appreciate this. So as you were talking about your book, one of my cats just knocked down a shitload of books off of the shelf, and I feel like that's a sign. Like, I feel like Carly wants people to buy your book.
Haley, my cat, wants people to buy the book, too.
Does she, like, eat it? Because my cats eat paper.
No, but she's standing here on the bed wanting some serious attention. I can actually hear her purring through my headphones.
That's amazing. So, yeah, if you want more information about what Rebecca's doing, tell us where we can find your website.
Sure. It's www.rebecca, R-E-B-E-C-C-A, Lombardo, LOMBARDO.com. And I have all of my social media links on that site. But I'm on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, you name it, I'm on there. So Twitter's...
We can follow you. It's at Becca Lombardo, B-E-K-A.
Hmm. Yep, on okay. Twitter, it's at Becca Lombardo. That's also Instagram is the same way, and it's, like you said, it's B-E-K-A and not B-E-C-C-A. And Facebook is facebook.com/notyourjourney.
Love it. Thank you so much for hanging out with me, and let's do this again sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. We'd love to have you back on our show, too.
Love it. I'm into it. Well, talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.